This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
As I've begun thinking about existentialism, it's struck me that a number of plays I've worked on in recent years have focused on the role of identity and the crucial importance given to individual choice. Prospero, in The Tempest, spends much of the play confronting and rebuilding his life, ultimately choosing reconciliation with those who have betrayed him. In Heroes, three war veterans have been neglected by society and try to escape their nursing home, forgetting that they're not quite what they used to be. In all these plays, the protagonists at some point in the proceedings confront a crucial choice that will affect their own perceived nature of themselves, as well as representing wider options in the way that an audience chooses to live their own lives. However, the most extreme embodiment of existentialist ideas in a play that I've come across is Hui Klo, which I directed for the Donmar Warehouse last year. Written in 1944, the author Jean-Paul Sartre seems to physically depict the very condition that he so widely invoked. Existentialism became a term which evoked so much more than he or any of his contemporaries could really have imagined or probably have hoped. The idea of it somehow took precedence over the substance and took on a rather sensationalised, and perhaps more detrimentally, a fashionable reputation. It seems to me that this is intrinsically linked to its historical birth point at the time of the Parisian occupation. Therefore, the central ideas of individual choice and the knock-on effects of such choices could not have had a more potently emotional and politically divisive effect. This certainly caused great argument and even greater misinterpretation of these initial ideas. In Hui Klo, the main characters are locked in a room together, rather suspicious of the environment and their hosts, as they believe themselves to be dead. The place has the feel of a crumbling, decrepit hotel. Physically, they don't appear to bear any of the marks of death. The multifarious, preconceived ideas that they have about the afterlife are, to all intents and purposes, ridiculed as they detract from seemingly the reason why they are there, to confront their own actions. Far worse for them than physical torture is the possibility that they might be left to work out the reasons as to why they've been trapped in this room, and to face the fact that life continues without them. Their own hubris becomes essential, as they must overcome their own pride and confront the reality of their earthly lives, although there seems no real hope of any sort of escape or indeed much beyond the walls at all. They are left instead to fight each other, fall in love, and eventually to try and kill. This process of birth into the room, followed by battle, love, and death, can be seen as a microcosm of life's more essential and basic experiences happening in a much shorter time span. All of these actions are utterly futile in this environment, and therefore perhaps suggest the futility of these actions in life as well. With this loss of hope, characters are forced to ask deeper and more penetrating questions in the face of what Sartre might term as their God-shaped hole of the consciousness. Essentially, in the face of a godless afterlife, they have to face up to the reality of their own past actions. Some would argue this is pessimism on the author's part. Others may draw positivity in this knowledge and argue it as realism. Either way, it makes for hugely provoking theatre, as Sartre embodies this essential conflict of emptiness into the very fabric and structure of how he writes the play. Rather than the traditional beginning, middle and end, therefore, it actually works in cycles, which has a huge impact on the way in which you have to think about and then stage the piece. For me and the rest of the creative team, it meant thinking about it in terms of recurring pictorial themes in lighting, staging and sound to alert an audience to a sense of déjà vu. For me, though, this structural impact of Sartre's composition was hugely startling, and really signalled to me in the first instance how the play totally breaks with theatrical convention. Hui Klo is usually assumed to be set in hell, but never really allows itself to be pinned down. Another reading could suggest a kind of purgatory, But perhaps this sort of phraseology misses the point anyway. There is, after all, great irony to this fact, given that existentialism fights against the very idea of there being a hell or purgatory. Also, Sartre is perhaps one of history's most infamous atheists, and I think there's quite an enjoyment in the breaking down of such terminology. However, the purpose of hell as a construct in the play is to reveal, in a pressurised environment, the choices that a human being undertakes. To add to this, I'm sure it must have struck Sartre at some point in the writing of the play that he, as author, is playing the role of God throughout. We staged the play in the tiny and claustrophobic Trafalgar Studios in London, close to Whitehall, which seats fewer than 100 people and gets very warm, not a choice, as one reviewer suggested. This allowed for real intensity and the sense of the audience being in the room with the characters. Our main impulse in the creation of the design was linked to the historical setting, not of the play necessarily, as this is left open-ended, but certainly to the period when Sartre would have been writing it. We felt this was of central importance, as it would have been during the period when the Nazis occupied Paris. Indeed, the length of the play was constricted by the need to conform to the curfew that had been imposed. So, the designer and I stuck firmly to the principles of Sartre's stage design, for example, the dated Second Empire furniture, as well as the period costume, but on top of this, everything was semi-destroyed, as if singed by mechanical warfare, with peeling wallpaper and rotting floorboards. The impact of these choices for the design allude to the translation of the play's title, Huis Clos, the most common of which being No Exit, suggesting that there must be no escape in the confrontation with the darker impulses and actions of the mind. But more apt, I think, is another translation, closer, I think, to its original sense, Behind Closed Doors, which evokes to a greater degree the legal implications of the title and suggests, intriguingly, some sort of contract which the three characters enter into, the very detail of which they have to invent with themselves. Sartre seems to be suggesting that if, as human beings, we have no purpose in an existence post-God, our natural aptitude seems to be, almost instinctively, to try and create one. One of the characters comments that nothing has been left to pure chance, questioning the setup behind them being in this room together. She says, "Is it mere chance that the room's been decorated like this? Try shifting the sofas or moving that thing on the mantelpiece." This question of whether the placement and articulation of the room is accidental or in fact designed is left unanswered by the author. This is also true of the other great mystery of whether the three were selected to be together, and the audience has to make a decision on their own here. What's clear in the creation of the setting, though, is that it uses furniture in such a way that nothing is there that allows them to be themselves naturally, and only ever really functions as an encumbrance and an obstruction, even just in their imagination. Any object in the space, therefore, takes on huge significance. I think that the way we designed our production pushed this further, so that, for example, when two characters attempt a sexual assignation, doing so on a broken sofa proves particularly dissatisfying, especially when there's a presence in the room watching their every move. It's only now, because of these combining factors, that in this place, after death, people actually begin to question who they really were and what they've actually done. The word sin is notably absent in Stuart Gilbert's translation, I'm sure for the very reasons we've already mentioned in terms of religious terminology. But perhaps what's most crucial of all is the realisation that actually it's too late to do anything about these heinous acts. With the knowledge that this is being performed to a group of living individuals who can alter or at least realise the impact of their own actions, the idea takes on a greater significance. The crucial moment of the play is one of great theatricality, as the only entrance into the space, a locked door, springs open. The brilliance of this moment, which epitomises Sartre's view of human behaviour, is that not one of the three protagonists have the courage to make their bid for freedom. They're already too institutionalised, too afraid of the world beyond these walls, and too utterly dependent on the other people in the room. They hate each other, and yet they cannot escape each other. Hell is not so much other people, but the utter dependency that we have on those around us. Because of this central action and the way that it feeds the construction of the play as a whole, I feel that Huiclo becomes Sartre's clearest physical analogy in communicating the idea of existentialism. It's a true physical expression of this philosophical idea, and yet, of course, the play's real power lies in its ability to create characters that you might not like, but that you certainly care about, and to do so in a believable setting. This is all given extra weight by the extremity of circumstances and its inferences of hell. So the play's influence is far more wide-reaching than the existential ideas it might convey. In its essence, it forces very directly an audience to confront the issues of choice and the nature of existence, and from this point of view, must surely have influenced the likes of Beckett and Pinter. Another play that I've worked on recently is Carl Zuckmayer's The Captain of Köpenick at the National Theatre, a play conceived nearly 15 years before the ravages of World War II, yet deeply prescient in terms of its predictions. A down-and-out Wilhelm Voigt is released onto the streets of Berlin after 15 years behind bars. Institutionalised to the extreme, he is left to fight governmental rules and regulations that ostracise and leave him desolate in his search for a passport and a job. There's a sense in the play that he doesn't quite exist without the paperwork, and that he's therefore stuck in this perpetual spiral of crime and violence. In this play, it's only the eventual accidental donning of an officer's uniform that propels him through the social hierarchy. The effect is immediate. People salute him and follow his every order. Voigt learns to play off this very quickly and becomes more and more convincing in the role, taking on the persona of an officer. It all reveals the flawed nature of a bureaucratically conditioned state too easily duped by a uniform. But the real joy for an audience is in seeing the improvised nature of a man creating a new version of himself and the way in which he manages to pull the wool over people's eyes. This gives the whole thing a sense of existential farce, and the audience are very much in on the joke. I find this gives a powerfully evocative sense in the way that people create or recreate this sense of a self in life, and the simplicity of this as a theatrical convention. Therefore, for me, the theatre seems to be a logical and indeed perfect arena for the discussion and interpretation of existential ideas, and writers from different generations, consciously or subconsciously, seem to respond to that. This is pushed even further by the sense of a metaphorical setting which isolates and clarifies the impact of individual choice. For example, the desert island in The Tempest and hell or purgatory in Huiclo. At these extremes, individual choice has more dramatic consequences. In all of these productions, the very fact of them being acted out on stage, I find, ultimately revealing. The actor-audience divide heightens dramatic decision and forces the audience to take a position. We're dealing with the very fabric of humanity and the possibility of choice in everyday lives, heightened and pushed to their most extreme ends.